Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I do interviews with entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And when I was a kid, the only chips that were available to us in the store were just Lay's potato chips, pretty much the exact same thing as all the competitive chips. And I remember as I got a little bit older, even as a teenager, I said, I'm not that excited about chips. I wish it was something a little bit healthier. I'm kind of into healthy food, but it's not around. And now there's like this healthy food revolution where healthy food is actually tasty, where it's interesting, and it's available in more and more places. And at the forefront of that is a company called Rhythm Superfoods. They make healthy snack foods that you can buy, snack on, and share. And the co-founder of the company is actually, Scott, are you the single founder of the company? No co-founder this time.
No, there's co-founders. Yeah, I had a couple of guys that started it with me.
Okay. There's Scott Jensen. He is the co-founder of Rhythm Superfoods. I invited him here to talk about how he created this company, why he took on such giants in the chip and snack business, and why there's such a change in the way that snacks are sold and bought today. This whole interview is sponsored by two companies. The first will host your website, right? The second is a conference that I'm going to. So the first is HostGator, and the second is Fireside Conference. I'll tell you more about them later. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm sure you get asked this a lot, so maybe you have a ready answer. What's your favorite snack of all the ones that you produce?
So like when we were running a barbecue sauce business, the Stubbs barbecue sauce business, we still have the Stubbs barbecue restaurant here in Austin. It's a great, great place, great live music venue, but awesome barbecue. I always wanted the restaurant to turn into a Chinese restaurant once a week because you get tired of the same old things. Mm-hmm. So I often find myself adapting to our new products and loving them. I've been eating kale chips for 6 years now, and it takes a lot to get me excited about kale chips now. So I think our beet chips, there's a coconut sugar and cinnamon version, which puts a little bit of sweetness on it. Mm-hmm. That's my favorite snack right now that we make. I love other snacks too. I'm a big fan of nut snacks and I love dried fruits and all kinds of snacks, but the beet chips are my favorite right now.
I know Stubbs, by the way, which you brought up, because I go to South by Southwest from time to time. And at South by Southwest, they will often do events at Stubbs. I think I even did an event at Stubbs, right? And so I didn't know that you founded it. I thought it was named after a musician, wasn't it?
Well, the guy Stubb himself, if you think of the Stubbs barbecue sauce, mm-hmm. That is the gentleman on the bottle is C.B. Stubblefield. Mm-hmm. And
who went by the name Stubb.
Yep. And he was born in East Texas. I traveled a lot throughout the Southwest, sharecropped for the early part of his life, joined the Army, and went to the Korean War, twice decorated with injuries in line of duty, came back and was wondering what he was going to do with his life. So he created a career of barbecue excellence and learned how to barbecue better than anyone else.
I see.
And it was his excellence that caused us to start the barbecue sauce company. So his face on the bottle, that's the name. He loved music though, always loved music, was always entangled with, dozens of musicians in Austin and West Texas. And that's really the folks that gave him the start were these wonderful famous musicians that basically would play at his small little honky tonk place in Lubbock for free, mm-hmm. to bring a crowd in to make him a little bit of money. So his heart was in music. So when we opened the Stubbs here in Austin, we built a big stage and a big live music amphitheater. So it's about a 3,000 person amphitheater right in downtown Austin with live music.
I see.
Sold out shows, 90 or 100 of them a year.
I see. I kind of assumed that he was a musician. I guess he wasn't, but I do see the music connection to it. What I'm wondering
he would get on the stage and sing. So to a certain degree, he was a musician.
How did you get into that? Why go into food?
My background from the early days of stealing the Frito Bandito erasers out of Frito-Lay corn chip packages when I was 6 years old in public supermarkets. My fascination with food.
You used to go into the supermarkets, take out the eraser from the bag and let the bag sit there on the shelf afterwards?
Yeah, until my mom found out and like made me go tell the store director what I was doing. And that was also my first interaction with a store director. So I just, for whatever reason, early fascination with consumer products. you know, did my undergraduate and graduate degree basically focusing on marketing, worked for a major advertising agency in Dallas out of undergraduate, and then worked for big brands, Dixie Cups and Dixie Plates, when I came out of my MBA. And we wrote a barbecue sauce business plan with Stubb while I was getting my MBA. My two partners in Stubb and I did. And so we started that barbecue sauce business because we loved him, loved the food, and figured that if we could make a business out of it, my friends and I were kind of like displaced Texans up in the New York area, that was going to be our magic carpet ride back to Texas, which it was. We ended up getting some of our friends to invest in the barbecue sauce company that came first. And we all moved down to run a barbecue sauce business.
So it was first barbecue sauce. And this was after you were working as a doing marketing for Dixie Cups and Plates.
You know, we started writing the business plan literally when I was roommating with one of my partners, John Scott, and Eddie Patterson. My other partner was in New York City, displaced Texans too. Stubb called up our apartment, and he was broke and needed some money to pay his rent. And John led the charge in raising from friends and family like $1,400, $1,500, sent it down to him and said, you know, get out of Hawk. And that was it. And a couple months later, he decided to send some hot barbecue, actual barbecue meat in a cooler, counter to counter. Back before 9/11, you could go to a counter of American Airlines and say, please ship this to another airport. And so he did that. And 3 hours later, we had a hot cooler of barbecue, several bottles of his barbecue sauce that he had mixed up for us. And they were in old Jack Daniels bottles. And the light bulbs went off and it was like, let's start a barbecue sauce company. So we spent the next year and a half kind of daring each other to quit our jobs, but also writing the business plan, talking to people about what it takes to start a company. And
then we see there. I mean, I get the that you like the food. What I'm guessing, what I'm trying to understand is, as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, what did you see in the market that led you think, I can come in here, I could actually create a product that sells, I could build a real business?
Two things. One was authenticity. Stubb himself was as honorable a man as I've ever met, and he was true to his, you know, quality roots. If it was going to have his face on the label, it had to be excellent. The feedback from people that tried his barbecue and his barbecue sauce were basically saying it's better than anything I've ever had in my life. Mm-hmm. So you have this like instant consumer gratification. So that makes you think that it's all going to work out. The second part is when you're young, you're a little dumb and you don't do all the, all the research that you probably do later in life. And so really we didn't want to take no for an answer. And when we looked at the category, we're like, who can't succeed in the barbecue sauce world? You know, there's only 75 other regional players that are selling to regional supermarkets. Yeah. And there's five multi-billion dollar corporations dominating 90% of the shelf. So we were just dumb.
And it turned out to have gone well for you. How much revenue did you hit at your height?
I think with the sale of it 2 years ago, it was in the mid 30 millions. So not a $400 million. The barbecue sauce category is, you know, $500-600 million. So we were like number three, number four player in the branded category of barbecue sauce and marinade. Strong, the strongest independent, of course.
So why did it work out for you? Because frankly, if we were looking at this back then, I would have told you, stop it. Look at the competitors. Look at how they have reach here. And for what? Barbecue sauce that someone's going to have to try first? And how are you going to get them to try it? It's not like you can throw a barbecue at the supermarket and explain to them what they're tasting. So what was it? What allowed you? And I know we want to talk about Rhythm Superfoods. That's my goal here. But I've got to ask you about this. Why did it work out? What did you do?
So first of all, you are right. You're talking about a category of barbecue sauce that was growing at 1% to 3% a year, so no growth in it, kind of growing at the population, and that's not very good. So that's a macroeconomic, you know, indicator that's wrong. When we got into it, the marinade category blew up for 4 or 5 years. There was no marinade category. And that gave a lot of extra space in the condiment aisle. And we just happened to be early adopters at developing marinades and launched them early. People were using salad dressings to marinate their chicken, and there was no category. So a little bit was luck, and that helped growth for 3 or 4 years. But ultimately, it was one of those things where you're either strong and won't take no for an answer, and when you get kicked in the stomach, you get back up. That's what the perseverance is in an entrepreneur's success story, typically, because you're going to get kicked. There's only a couple of like brilliant unicorns per decade that come out of nowhere with an unbelievable idea. And you, even with those, you think it's simple, but it's not. This business is hard. So I think perseverance and having a good team of people that you trust. My friends were people that were like, they were the ones sleeping in the car next to me if we didn't have money for a hotel. So
an example of something that you did that would have knocked most people over, or a time when you felt like you could have gotten knocked over back then.
I remember my partner, Eddie Patterson, was in Cincinnati making a presentation to, I think his name was Steve Smith at Kroger. And we had this really cool old Bluebird school bus, like a yellow school bus. But there was a gentleman in Central Texas called Reverend Bobby Love, his name was. And he had converted that school bus into a camper. And it was painted red, white, and blue, like the flag of Texas. And so we would drive that around because we had a smoker inside and a full bar, and you could kind of plug into the Campground of America for $12 and not pay $80 for a hotel. So it was kind of like the roaming sales machine. And so Eddie had driven it up to Cincinnati to see Kroger, and went in and made his presentation for our line of barbecue sauces. And sometimes when you're a young company, you kind of have to prove yourself. Might have been the third year that we had been presenting to Kroger. And Eddie parked the big bus camper outside, and it was something to see. It was part of our personality. It had all the Stubbs memorabilia inside of it. So after he had this, what he believed a successful, you know, meeting with the buyer up there, the broker we were with said, you know, you really need to, like, let's go to lunch. You got to see this camper that they drive around and make sales calls with. And to someone at such a big retailer like Kroger, that's kind of a interesting, funny little thing. I'll go see your old Texas camper. So Eddie had parked, I think, next to a fire hydrant. So by the time he had come down there, they spent 30 minutes walking down to it, just hyping up how great this thing was. And, you know, Steve was hard to talk into going to lunch. By the time they went down there, you know, when you, if you've ever like lost your car in a parking garage, you're like kind of confused and disoriented for the first few minutes. And it's like, I think I parked it right here. And so, you know, there was a fire hydrant, nothing parked in front of it. So yeah, he had been towed. And of course, that was like the end of the lunch. He's like, no, I don't have time for this. I got to go back in. And, you know, Eddie had looked at that as like the marker that we had failed. You know, 2 months later, we had found out we made the cut. And that was the first time we got in with three of our barbecue sauce flavors. And so, you know, you get kicked in like that. You think you're doing well, you make a product and the first runs of it are 30,000 bottles of it. And you didn't think you had to pasteurize it because it didn't have enough, you know, the pH was a certain level. And then two months later, bottles are popping in the stores because
that
there's too much
pressure. 30,000 of them?
Yeah, so we did a run, and the technology and the pH and everything was there. There was like, we really don't need to cook this. It's going to be shelf stable for a year based on the pH level and the acidity in it. And we were wrong on that, and so were the food scientists that told us. So we had, you know, we had sold 30,000 bottles worth of stuff. And you know, people were opening it, and as they opened it, the cap was bursting, and people were getting sprayed on their clothing and asking for reimbursement. So all of those things are the entrepreneur's journey, particularly in the very beginning, the first time. You just make so many mistakes. But if you can pick yourself up by your bootstraps and get up the next day, something good's going to happen if something bad happened the day before.
What was it that got you to keep going? What was it? I was just talking to an entrepreneur who'd gone bankrupt, and he said, I can't go back there again. And he wrote on everything that he could. He wrote the number 10,000 because that was his goal. And now he's got a cabinet company that's doing really well. The 10,000 would be a slow hour for him. But he needed that vision to keep him going. What was it for you that got you to keep going?
I could see it. Here at Rhythm, you know, we're 6 years into our journey right now. And you know, there are days where we're kind of produce oriented. We're very deep into the supply chain of produce. We've got to have kale and beets and broccoli growing in two or three different regions of where we're making the products, because storms come in, wash out the fields, make it difficult to get in and pick. So we're really kind of produce people. And so, we've got to keep our eyes on the weather. And that's something I never had to do in the barbecue sauce world.
Yeah. But
you get kicked in the stomach every now and then. You think you've got it all figured out, and then Mother Nature tells you something else. And you either have it to get up and know when you see the white canvas, you're like, okay, I can see it. It's coming together. It's like being in the Matrix almost. I see the ones and zeros on this blank canvas, and I know where we're heading. Sometimes we'll go a little slower than I'd like. Maybe the cash is burning faster than you'd like. Maybe you're getting no's more often than yeses than you thought. But, an entrepreneur feels it because you're touching all the areas in the business. Right now, that's what I feel about Rhythm, same way I felt in Stubbs. And I knew it's for Stubbs, I don't think we broke even until like the eighth or ninth year of doing business. Now, we lived lean and took very little investment to turn that company into a success. But, sleeping in cars is something you do when you're 25. I'm not sure I'm going to do that, in my 50s.
There's two other things before we move on from Stubbs. The first is you told our producer about how you manufactured the first bottles. And Stubb used to actually make it himself. I think I read it was he would put it in jars. He would jar it himself. Yeah. What were the jars made out of that he used?
Yeah, they were like, that little glass mason jars, the kind your mom would put jelly or jam in, right?
So you guys said, we're going to turn this into a business. We're going to produce some. And you decided you were going to produce it yourselves. Where'd you get the ingredients? How'd you bottle the first ones?
Yeah, so the first time when he was bottling it alone, we had a very, very small commercial kitchen here in Austin and a small little 60-gallon kettle over a burner. And we were actually buying the ingredients from HEB at retail. So we were buying the tomato paste in little 6-ounce cans and buying the Worcestershire sauce in little 8-ounce bottles. And, took a long time to make a case of barbecue sauce that way. A lot of cans to open up. And so we're buying the ingredients retail and then selling the finished goods wholesale. So that's a recipe for cash burn, by the way. Buying your ingredients retail.
Yeah.
So we were introduced to a company that was up in the Dallas area, contract manufacturer. And when we first started, we didn't even know what a contract manufacturer was. But they had the equipment for 500-gallon and 1,000-gallon jacketed kettles, an automatic filling line that was filling bottles at 60 bottles a minute and labeling at 100 bottles a minute. And we go in there and they're already making barbecue sauces for four or five other people. So they're buying tomato paste by the truckload at, 30 to 32 cents a pound. And we're buying it basically at like $1 a pound. So the word scale and scalability and what that meant to operations and production and what it does to cost of goods. It was one of those like eureka moments, like, wow, we just dropped our cost of goods by like 2/3. So it was finding a good contract manufacturer that
shows how green you were, that you didn't know about this, that you didn't go in there looking for this. And still you built this company, you sold it. But do you remember like when the sale felt real? Was it when the wire came through? Was it some other time? Can you take me to that moment when you sold the business?
Yeah. So I had already started Rhythm Superfoods. So I was a shareholder and a board member at the time, and obviously involved as a board member with the sale process, but not as the lead person leading the sale. I was still leading Rhythm Superfoods. So a lot of meetings. When you have big companies that are buying companies, there's lots of legal things that you have to make sure that you're completely tied up on. And so the processes like that take months. And I think by the time we had said we were prepared to go into that process, it was probably about 8 months later that it was finally consummated. And I don't think like during the entire process, there wasn't a lot of discussion about the money per se. The company was so emotionally tied to all of us, not only us as people that founded it, but the investors. They're like family. They're all family and friends. And we had gone through a 20-year sojourn of building a company together. And so there was a lot of sentimental moments of conversations of, hoping and praying that, you know, the quality of the brand and what we had tried to build was going to stay in the right hands. And we found the right company to do that, first of all, with McCormick. But that was more of the sense of like, when is it real? Well, when it was real, when some of the McCormick leadership came down and one of my partner, John Scott, had the entire company over for a success dinner, if you will. We've successfully transferred the brand over to these new owners. And I think that was the moment for me. It was real. It was, you know, physically meeting several of the folks that were going to manage the brand after that. The money had already wired, and that was good. It was nice to be able to make sure that there was a safety blanket for my wife and my two sons, and for after working for so many years on it. But really, it was more about the brand. When you work from the very beginning for 20 years on something, it's really your baby.
And are struggling for the first 8 years to even break even, sleeping in your car. Wow. How much did you guys sell the business for?
A little over $100 million.
Wowee. Yeah. All right. Let me take a moment and then I'm going to come back. I'm going to take a quick sponsorship message break and then I'll come back and I want to ask you about how does a guy who sells barbecue get into kale? I thought the people who eat barbecues make fun of the people who eat kale. All right. First, I have to tell everyone that I'm going to be speaking and participating at a place called Fireside. Fireside is like a conference that doesn't have much of a conference. It has more about the conversation. Do you go to a lot of conferences, Scott?
We go to so many trade shows every year. There's barely time for the conferences.
Yeah, the problem with conferences is that you sit down and you're supposed to watch people for 8 hours. And for the most part, it's boring and you don't want to sit in place anyway. That's why we left school, right? What we want is to get to know the other people who are going to the event. And so that's what Fireside decided to do. They said, you know what? Let's forget all the boring speeches. Let's just get rid of the slides and the PowerPoint and all that and just create an environment where people can get together, fireside style, cabin style, and get to know each other. And so what they're going to do is they're going to have water skiing and tennis and basketball and rock climbing, which I'm excited about. There's a private lake, which I'm looking forward to swimming in. I'm sure I'm going to get to do some running. I'm a pretty active person. There are going to be meals that we'll all get to have together. We're all going to sleep in cabins together. In fact, they said, Andrew, you're a big shot. Do you want your own private room, your own private cabin? I said, no. If everyone else is sleeping together with other people in their rooms, I want that. I want that kind of bonding. And so that's the idea here. We're going to get a bunch of entrepreneurs together to learn from each other, to hang out with each other, to drink scotch together. I'm hoping to do scotch night there, to have dinner. If you are listening to me and want this kind of experience, go to not just firesideconf.com, but go to a special URL where they're going to have you skip the line, skip the invitation process, and automatically get accepted in. The URL is firesideconf.com/mixergy. We're going to get to have dinner together, get to talk, get to know what we're all working on, and also put the phones and computers and everything away and just have fun experiences together. That's the idea here. That's why, even though I say no to so many conferences, I do not want to speak at them. I've said yes to being an active part of this one, speaking, but that's more like leading a conversation there and having dinner and hanging out with everyone. So if you want to be a part of it, go to this URL, firesideconf.com/mixergy. This is my last time talking about them, so write it down, firesideconf.com/mixergy. That's conf as in conference, firesideconf.com/mixergy. All right, so let's get into how you got into kale chips. It had to do with these two guys that you met. Who are these two guys and what was it about them that drew you into this business?
Yeah, so when I was preparing to jump from Stubbs to something else, I didn't really know what I was going to do. But I knew I wanted to do something, and I knew I wanted to do it in the area of expertise that I have, which is food. And at the time, and this was only a little over 6 years ago, the natural products and organic products world has escalated a lot in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. But for the 3 or 4 or 5 years previous to that, it was pretty nascent. And even though we're here in Austin, where Whole Foods is headquartered, Stubbs, in one of the ingredients that we had, I think there was originally some sodium benzoate in the Worcestershire sauce we were using that was originally Stubbs' original Worcestershire sauce brand that he used. And we finally figured out how to asked that producer if they had a version without sodium benzoate. And then suddenly we had a natural product that could go into Whole Foods. So it was only in the last couple of years that I was at Stubbs that we were even aware of the boom that was happening in the natural organics products business. And so I just started paying more attention to it, went to a couple of the expo trade shows in California 2 years in a row, and committed myself personally just on my own, you know, path, fork in a road, about to leave Stubbs. What do I want to do? Decided I wanted to work with a company that was manufacturing something with transparency, with health, with benefits. And I didn't know what it was. So I had to kind of wander around a little bit and talk to a lot of people. But one of my co-founders, Clayton Christopher, who had started Sweet Leaf Tea Company and sold that to Nestle, also started the Deep Eddy Vodka Company and just recently sold that about 2 years ago to Heaven
Hill.
One of
your co-founders of Stubbs is also the creator of Sweet Leaf Tea?
No, the co-founder of Rhythm Superfoods.
Got it. Okay. He was also the creator of Sweet Leaf. Okay. So you guys were friends.
He had just sold his interest in Sweet Leaf Tea to Nestle Waters. And so I was just leaving Stubbs, and he had a couple of ideas and turned me on to a couple of gentlemen, Robbie Larkin and Keith Warr. And Keith Warr was a founder of a company down here called a co-founder of a company called Daily Juice. And that's it's a juice and smoothie bar here in Austin and elsewhere. But they had a little dehydrator in the back of one of their restaurants, juice bars. And they were dehydrating and making kale chips and putting them into bags for, you know, 1.5 ounces of dried kale chips. And they were also making them there. It's a commercial kitchen. It's a county health inspected commercial kitchen. And they were selling them to 2 or 3 stores, like 1 or 2 Whole Foods and then a co-op, Wheat Sale co-op here. And for $9.95, they could barely keep them on the shelf. And it was 1.5 ounces of kale chips. And I was like, this is pretty cool. This is a new way of thinking about snacks, taking, you know, vegetables from the garden and, you know, for the kale chips, mixing them with a flavor of some sort, creating some sort of season, you know, whether it's sweet or savory, and making it crunchy and shelf stable in a package that we were all drinking the Kool-Aid, you know, change the universe and the snacking universe from Lay's potato chips and Doritos, which I still love and eat those too, but create an offering segment that was something where you could eat 5 bags of it and your doctor would say, good job. So that was the beginning of it. You know, a couple people dehydrating some kale chips in the back of a fruit and smoothie bar called Daily Juice. And from there, it was, let's create the concept in a different package and prove the concept out. So we brought in a couple of other people to write some checks. The original kind of financial founders and David Smith, who started Sweet Leaf Tea with Clayton and also started the company High Brew Coffee here in Austin. He was one of the original founding investors. You know, you just get in there and jump in and first start making more product and send.
Oh, I hope I didn't just lose you. Let's give the connection a moment to catch up. You know, you also told our producer that you sent out a few samples out to some friends in retail, to some brokers. You wanted to get feedback from them. What kind of feedback did you get from them?
First of all, we sent it to I wasn't sending it to like Kroger or Walmart, the big guys at that point. So we knew with as esoteric a product as this kale chip, no one had ever really seen it before. So we were sending it to a couple of regions of Whole Foods and brokers in the Whole Foods natural community, and they're big risk takers. They love something brand new, healthy, and it was a good story. It was something absolutely brand new that no one had ever seen before. So the feedback was phenomenal, universally delicious, awesome. But we were also, you know, we were hand making these things, you know,
again,
one leaf at a time at that point. So the cost of goods at that point were really not a concern. It was really about, let's get this product in the hands of thought leaders that we can trust their opinion. And mm-hmm. The opinions all came back really, really strong. And at that time, there was a lot of people trying to develop raw foods, things that were not cooked at a higher temperature, kind of a dietary belief in eating things that have a living enzyme in them. And so there was other people making other items that were considered raw. So we were dehydrating these kale chips at a relatively low temperature, and it would take literally overnight to dehydrate a batch of kale chips. So you'd put them in the afternoon, and then 6 in the morning, they're just dry enough to take out. My do not disturb, do not disturb. Sorry.
No problem. I get it. Let me ask you something. Do you believe, while you're doing that, do you believe in this raw food thing? Do you believe in this kind of food, or is it more of a business proposition for you?
So I from the very beginning, knew that we weren't going to go into something that I couldn't find the scientific efficacy for, because in the natural and organic channel, there's a lot of people hyping things. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say that it's not right or it's correct, because I know lots of people that are very raw in their consumption and they've got a great glow about them. They're incredibly healthy. But we were careful not to go deep into putting raw in our name and speaking too much about raw. And I think it wasn't that I wasn't believing, because I was eating a ton of raw stuff, but I wasn't also 100% raw eater. I was more careful just because there's FDA rules, there's consumer confusion rules.
As I've talked about unhealthy snacks, you've made a point a couple of times in this conversation to say, I also eat Doritos. I also eat this other stuff. It seems like – I'm wondering, how much is this your flavor? How much do you really enjoy this, and how much is it more of a business for you at this point?
I'm all in.
You're all in. This is your kind of food.
Yes, but like, it's part of my food. And again, it's a careful concern here, because I think for the first, in the beginning of the 60s through the 70s, the people that were proselytizing, say, a vegan or vegetarian lifestyle got stamped and tattooed as being hippies and out of control, and mm-hmm. they don't understand the real world. And sometimes just small little inches of change are monumental in a group of consumers. Like here in the United States, we've got massive obesity. We've got a lot of people that, if you just go after them with the finger pointing that you need to go vegan, you need to go vegetables, the only thing you do is plant-based this and that. And some people are very successful in their own personal lifestyle and diet doing that. But we made a careful effort to say, that's not the company we're going to be. We're not going to be the shouters. We're going to be the nudgers, because most of us are. We've cut 10, 20, 30% of our diets have turned much healthier in terms of the employees that are working here, and me, myself, the same. But I'm not a vegan, and I don't want to tell people that they have to be vegan to enjoy my products. Yeah. But if you just make a couple of changes here and a couple of changes there, you'll get used to the fact that it's not unusual to eat a product like this. It's not unusual to find a vegetable-based burger patty, to put that inside a bun instead of an actual, beef burger patty. On the other hand, I'm not going to tell someone that's eating a beef burger patty that they shouldn't, because that's not our mantra here. Okay. So it's not that we're not like full believers in one thing or other. We're believers in what we're doing, and we think it's right. We're just not shouting you need to be a plant-based only person.
All right. And so you had this idea, you had some validation, you raised some money, you were starting to professionalize the manufacturing, and then you go after some big retailers. You go, of course, after Whole Foods. They're very open to new ideas. In fact, they intentionally court new ideas. And you said you go after HEB retailers. Can you talk about those two and how you got those two first customers or early customers?
Yeah. So it's funny, because not everyone – I mean – when you show up with a bag of kale chips when no one has ever seen a bag of kale chips before, sometimes it takes a couple of meetings before people get over the first.
At grocery stores, even at Whole Foods?
Even at Whole Foods, yeah. So we weren't getting yeses immediately. But we did get a yes in the Southeast region based out of Florida. And that was the first one. We didn't necessarily get a yes for region wide here in the Southwest, where our own town was. We were still self-delivering to 5 or 6 of the single stores that would let us in, mm-hmm. but we weren't approved for the whole region. Got denied in the Mid-Atlantic region 2 times. So, there's hundreds of people like us coming up with products and going after them. There's a limited finite amount of space. So you don't expect everyone to take every product that you come out with. But HEB, there's a buyer down there that was pretty progressive, and they've got some really nice natural sets within the store that have a gluten-free section and a snack section and natural products section that can be anywhere from 2 to 4 aisles. And so for 100 to 140 stores at that time, Yvonne, the buyer there at the time, our buyer fell in love with them, and he gave us a chance and brought us in and put us on one of their Primo Pick promotions, which introduced everyone by putting a little end cap for one of the months when we first got in there. So conventional store, but with a real good natural set of stores that they market to. And then over the years, the subsequent 2 or 3 years, we got into all the Whole Foods. But you know,
you got into all the Whole Foods.
Yeah, eventually we did.
I see. I thought there was an issue with Whole Foods too.
Well, the way their model has worked, and it's, I think this year is the first time we're presenting to them on a national basis. Like the yes or no comes on a national basis this year. But traditionally they've been, you know, there's 10 or 11 stops you got to make depending on whether you want to go into Canada or not. And so our sales team literally has to go to each one of the regions back then and knock on the door, present the case, and those regional buyers are there to make sure that the products that are in tune with their region. You can imagine if you're in the Mid-Atlantic region, there's a lot of seafood versus someone that's buying for the Midwest office out of Illinois. So there's a difference in shelf sets in the Bay Area than there is in the Texas region. So each one of them has their own characteristics, and not every product is right until it becomes something national.
I thought it was, and by the way, if you notice that I was sitting down, I'm trying a stand-up desk. I've got to tell you, Scott, it's great when you're standing up and enjoying it, but after hours of standing up, I feel like it's a little much. And so I brought the bench out, or the little stool out that I've been experimenting with, and so much more comfortable. I think I'm going to do my interview sitting down again.
Okay.
I saw you looking because I've never just...
What brand did you buy? Because I'm looking at those too. They seem to say that they're healthier for you to stand up.
The stand-up sit-down desk, it's called...
Deep vein thrombosis disappears if you're not sitting on your butt all day long.
Uplift desk. It is really good.
That's the one that's for.
You get the right size that you want. I like the mechanics of it so I can set whatever height I want for it. The mistake I made was I also put a treadmill under here. I said, you know what? If I'm going to spend money on this, go all out. They have this flatbed. Yeah. The problem with that is if I'm working, I feel like it's a bit of a distraction to be on a treadmill. But we'll see. I'll give it another couple of days and then I'll decide.
You're hardly huffing and puffing at all during this interview.
No, I would turn it off for an interview. I think it'd be too distracting. For phone calls, though, when someone's not looking, I definitely could walk. And this is meant to be super quiet. And this is made by Lifespan, the treadmill. Super quiet. People can't tell I'm on it. I thought there was an issue with Whole Foods. You were telling our producer that one of the challenges you had was getting enough supply. You promised them a certain amount. You couldn't get it in there. Do you want to talk a little about that?
Yeah, so that was in the second or third year. So we had gotten into a couple of the regions. And I guess, you know, just to tell any entrepreneurs that aren't living their life this way, you know, you don't know how many people are going to say yes and how many are going to say no when you go out and pitch. And there is a cycle. And depending on your product, maybe if it was barbecue sauce, there's like a 2 to 3 month period of time from December to February that every supermarket reviews the category of the barbecue sauce and marinade. They make their decisions in March and April. And by Easter or Memorial Day, there's a brand new set that's going to live in that store for the next year. That's a cycle that happens around the country.
Wow.
But with the kale chips and some of the areas of the store where we were finding ourselves in natural snack, every retailer was not aligned with the exact same time. So we're going through and talking to this retailer in February, this one in April, this one in June, this one in October. And Whole Foods, on the other hand, the buyers from each of the regions were reviewing it all at the same time. And so we'd get around there and we're pitching all the Whole Foods regions. We were only in 2 of them at that time. And we're also making presentations to three or four other grocery chains. They were conventional stores. And you wait for the next month or two or three for the set to be determined. And over a 30 or 40 day period of time, we had three out of the four of the conventional retailers and three more regions of Whole Foods all say yes. And all of them were basically setting their shelves at the same time. And we flat out didn't predict that. There was almost like a 90% hit rate for the sales calls we had made. And the volume coming in at that time, in terms of orders, 60, 90 days later, was, you know, 50% more than our capacity of our machinery. So the machine, first of all, the machinery, these are $500,000 dehydrators and tray systems, and they take about 4 to 6 months when you put your deposit down to actually create them and make them. They're bigger than an 18-wheeler, so they're big, massive pieces of equipment. And they don't just sit, you know, they're not sitting on a lot like a Toyota Camry where you come in, buy it, take the key, and leave. So we got the yes, had to scramble to come up with the money, put the deposit down, plan on raising more funds to pay for the rest of it and the next growth that was going to happen. And we got caught short. There was probably 6 to 9 months where across evenly all of our customers, the new customers that we had promised we would have this product out, we were short shipping them. You know, 70, 80% of their orders were going out, which meant some of their shelves were empty. And in the grocery business, there's just no, like, there's no sympathy for that. No matter what your excuse is, they've got a job to do. They're filling their shelves. They've got margin and sales requirements, and they're giving you the shelf space. And if you can't manage to supply them what you promised, then, you know, there's a short fuse before they have to kind of take your stickers off and put someone else's stickers on the shelf. And that's what happened to us. There was a couple of regions where it was probably perceived that we were, you know, maybe shorting them, but not shorting someone else. And every retailer has to demand to be, you know, top of the list. We were just trying to treat everyone equally during this, you know, 4 or 5 month period of shortage. So we lost some regions that we had been approved for. So that stuff happens. That's the kicks in the stomach that you have to get up and try to you know, make something good happen the next year or the year after.
All right. I want to do one last commercial break here. And then when I come back, I want to ask you how you bounce back from that, from letting down a new customer like that. I want to find out how you're getting into so many stores. And more importantly, if there's someone listening to us, what they could learn about getting into a lot of retailers too. You told our producer about a couple of big challenges. We want to talk about that and how you deal with them. And finally, where your revenue is now. But first, let me tell the audience about a company called HostGator. When I started a brand new site, a brand new business, I wanted the best of the best hosting out there. And I went to HostGator. And HostGator is known for their inexpensive hosting packages. In fact, if you're getting started, there's no faster, easier, less expensive way, as far as I know, to get a WordPress website up and running right, and also get the right tech support to allow you to keep managing it without having downtime. But what I wanted was, I knew I was going to get hit with a lot of traffic. This is a new business that I'm creating. I knew that I was going to do large-scale webinars with hundreds of people, thousands of people, hundreds of people showing up after thousands register, and over, I wanted to keep promoting it. And I didn't want to go down for a day because this was brand new and I didn't want to lose customers. And so I went to HostGator and I didn't sign up for the basic plan. I'll be honest with you. I went all out. I went for their best of the best package and it was inexpensive, kept me up and running and allowed me to keep growing my business. And the reason I'm saying this is if you're out there and you have a website and you want good hosting, it's hard to find. A lot of hosting packages seem right when you sign up, but then they end up causing you trouble when you get an onslaught of traffic. That's why I'm recommending you sign up to HostGator. When you go to the special URL I'm about to give you, they're going to take their already low price and chop it in half, which means you can start off with as little as $3.48 a month to host your website. And if you, like me, want to keep growing it and scaling it, they will grow with you and with your needs for not much more money per month. They have dedicated servers, WordPress management, where they manage your WordPress. I forget the actual name of it, but they will manage your WordPress site and make sure that it's backed up and protected and all that, and their plugins aren't going to conflict with each other. So if you're looking for a website hosting company, here's a URL where you will get low prices chopped in half and where they will know you came from me, so they'll take especially good care of you guys. Go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. That's HostGator.com/Mixergy. All right, let's come back and talk about bouncing back, Scott. How did you bounce back from that issue where you couldn't meet demand, where you were short, what did you call it, short packaging them or short delivering?
Short shipping them.
Short shipping. How did you bounce back from that?
Well, first of all, you want to crawl up in your bed and not go to work because conversations are not going to be pleasant. So just had to prepare for that, first of all. And it's not like it's one call, right? So you call and let them know you're shorting them, and they're like, what the hell? And then 2 weeks later, you're calling, you're shorting again. You're trying to explain the situation. They're like, you either put me to the top or I'll find someone else. I've got competitors of yours that are dying to have your shelf space. Those are the kind of conversations you have because they've got objectives they've got to meet. So when someone finally says, you know, just can't deal with this anymore, you know, 3 months into it, you know, you beg and plead. Then you beg and plead.
Really?
So, yeah.
If you were on the phone saying, please, I can get this going. I've got a new company here. Don't crush us. Allow us to grow. That kind of thing.
Absolutely. You have to.
Because are they receptive to that?
If you, well, I remember one buyer wasn't. So she shut us off quick and didn't want to talk to us for another 2 years. But 2 years later, because we would pitch her every year, we finally got the yes. And so we spent a lot of time dealing with her region and making sure we were marketing to her region and making sure that we looked good in her region, not to her stores, but to the competitors around there, so that she would know that, like, when we finally got the new dehydrators in and got caught back up on capacity, you know, we spent a lot of time making sure that her competitors in that market had our products, not to do anything bad to her, but I wanted her to see us in that market. And we'd send her an email, you know, every 3 or 4 months saying, when you're up for review again, just know that we're back up to snuff. We can handle your business. You know, she and her team put a lot of work into putting our products on the shelf. And then they had to do a lot of work to take us off the shelf and put someone new in. Yeah. So you got some bruised egos and sometimes that happens, but you gotta keep your chin up. And you got to keep friendly with these people. Someone that might be pressing their thumb down on you right now may need your help a year later in a different position than they're in. So
you mean the next job that they're in?
Yeah, you're going to see them around in different jobs. And so don't let a bridge get burned when these things happen. Just know that you can come back to it. And we came back to her. She was the one that eventually said, okay, now I'm going to give you a shot again. Sometimes you have to wait until there's a change of position and there's a new buyer there so that, you know, you can create a new relationship.
What else do you do to build relationships to allow you to get into so many stores? What is it about you guys that allows you to get into stores so fast?
Well, first of all, we go to all the trade shows that are relevant to us, the expos, East and West. We go to the fancy food shows, East and West, because we also do a pretty good piece of business in the produce department. We've got some snack sets and snack racks and a whole produce ethos, because all of our stuff is coming from gardens, if you will. We go to the PMA show. Produce Marketing Association. That's their big trade show for the produce department. We'll be at NACS, the convenience store show, this year for the first time, because we've now got single serve small bags. So we're there when the industry converges. I don't go to as many seminars or confabs or get togethers or I would love to, but
it's all about showing to potential customers what you've got.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And we're getting to the point where most of the retailers for our top items have us in their best stores. We may not be in 100% of their stores, but we're in the right sets with our best products.
But so isn't Scott just about going to the fancy food show and other trade shows? Like, if there's someone listening to us who's got a new drink, who's got a new food, and he's saying, I want to learn from Scott. This guy's been in this industry longer than I have. What can I do to get in those stores? What advice would you give them based on your experience? What's worked for you that would work for them?
Well, first of all, I was listening to a gentleman this morning tell me that he was in a Costco in one of the regions, and it was early on in their career, and he was actually in the Costco store. It's one of the ones that's right next to where their regional buying office is. And so he was in there at the customer service desk with a couple of packages of his products in their earliest package form. And he's standing in line with all the people, like, bringing back TVs and, you know, frozen blintzes and whatever else they're bringing back to get the refund for. And he's there to basically say, hey, how do I talk to someone that lets me in and sells my stuff in the Costco? And so that story resonates with me. It's like that just happened because that store is right next to the buying office. The buyer for that region in the category that he was in just happened to be in the store at that time. And when he approached the customer service desk, the person that was running the desk knew that they had seen the category manager, the buyer, and kind of microphoned her over on her cell or something like that, and had her come over. And that introduction took place. They're now doing a ton of business with that region of Costco. So as simple as you need to know the store you're going to. You can't just like call up the buyer and say, I'm ready to go into your stores. How many of the stores have you gone into where you know where your products are? Is your bottle of barbecue sauce like this big, but the shelf is this big? Mm. Like you have to know the store. How wide is it? How many products are there on there? What's the price of the high end and the low end of the product that's there? Are there restrictions in that particular store that not that the particular store itself, but there are certain stores like a Whole Foods that if you don't know what the ingredient restrictions are and you're making your stuff with something with 7-aminobenzoate, you don't call up that buyer. So learn the store first of all, because if you go in there and haven't visited their stores, don't know how they merchandise, haven't picked up their little flyers, and you know how they go to market with their mm-hmm. with their weekly promotions, then you're not talking the language, and you're likely to fail because the buyer is going to know that you haven't even done your homework. Second thing is, and I think this is the most important, is you can be successful within the 100 or 200 or 300 miles of your centric circle here. I'm in Austin. I can drive in 3 hours to Dallas or Houston or San Antonio, and I can manage that business. But there's a whole life outside of your circle there that are hundreds of retail brands that you can be selling your products in. And I'm not saying you come out of the gate, right out of the gate, jumping into New York and California and Chicago and Florida, but you need expertise in those regions. And there are brokers, sales brokers within our industry that are experts for retailers in their region. So there's a lot of paperwork to fill out. There's a language that each retailer, they don't talk about customers at Costco. They talk about members. They don't talk about stores. They talk about warehouses. So it's a different language at every retailer you go to. And so you can be eloquent and knowledgeable and be that person that is already sophisticated by knowing the store you're going into and going in with someone within that region that has expertise. So hiring a broker to represent you, mm-hmm. they're the ones that know when the reviews are happening for a specific category. They'll make sure that you're prepared for it. They'll review your documents, make sure your sales presentation doesn't, if you're going in to see Whole Foods, it doesn't have the Albertsons logo on the front of the thing because you forgot to take it off. So expertise is one thing, and knowing the store before you go in there.
This really is like old-fashioned sales. It's not about landing pages and emails and templates and all that. It's old-fashioned sales. Know your customer, have a good presentation, keep beating those, not beating the doors, but keep beating a path to their door over and over.
Yeah. I mean, it's Willie Loman 101. You literally have to put the leather shoes on and go hit the street and talk to people. And the first time they see you, the buyers are trained to reach out and find new things because they've got to. That's what they have to do. If they're putting shields up to block you, they're not doing their job. So just know that is their job. They're paid to find things that are exciting and to be first to market in their market with something that's exciting and new. So they are looking for you. All they want to do is they want to reduce their risk of failure. So they want to know that you know what you're talking about. So if you can prove to them through a few little things that you know what you're talking about, like, yeah, go into their stores. If you go in there and you say, hey, I'd like to be in your stores and I'd like to knock this brand off the shelf. And they're like, well, we don't carry that brand. He knows immediately, or she knows immediately, that you don't know what you're talking about, and the high risk of failure, which means they're going to look bad because you're not a business person that has done your homework. That's a high risk to them. So make sure they know that you know what you're talking about. Going in with a broker often reduces that risk.
We asked you about big challenges and you said, look, one of the big challenges is how quickly people's opinions of their diets change. What do you mean by that? And how is that a challenge for a business?
Yeah, I was talking to some folks this morning about that. And yesterday, it was top of my mind right now. So if you were a manufacturer 20 years ago and you wanted to sell your cereals, you'd have all three networks Saturday morning, Tony the Tiger talking to him at 8 in the morning and 9:30. Mm-hmm. And you make sure you've got the product stacked high in the stores that week. And the kids walking down the aisle with their moms are saying Tony the Tiger. And that's how a brand becomes a mega brand, a big brand, right? And so the big CPG companies were able to build an incredible, you know, we have the best food in this country. Everyone trashes what's been going on. But as we moved into things like organics and non-GMOs, but these big CPG companies were able to create a pipeline of food that's delicious for very little money for us. But those brands, as we've learned now, maybe you shouldn't be eating as much sugar. Maybe you should. Some people have gluten intolerances. So dynamics change. A person that has a dehydrator in their garage, mm-hmm, can, if given the right voice through social media and blogging about how they look at diet, not diet in terms of reduction of weight, mm-hmm, losing weight, but diet, just what I eat. If you have a belief system that you think that people should be eating hamburger meat that's made out of vegetable proteins, and you're able to get millions of people to follow your lead, then you've got a brand new brand that's disrupting an inherent industry like the meat industry. At the same time, there's someone that's basically saying, you know what, that's like Frankenfood. What we really need is, you know, buffalo and bison roaming free range and putting their hooves in the ground to make the soil rich. And we can cull those herds in a responsible way and create enough meat protein in a responsible way that we're not having to create scientific food. Both of those people have a voice. And because of the nature of the internet, they're able to build a strong brand as strong as Tony the Tiger was without having to spend $150 million on marketing. So anyone with a product and a social voice is able to create a following if what they do and say and make is believable.
So do you do that socially, using social media? Are you creating a voice? Are you out there doing this?
Or
is that your next?
No, we're pretty strong on all the major social media networks, but we're not trying to proselytize. I get worried about the snake oil salespeople that are inherent in the food and beverage industry. And so I don't like to see people that are coming so close to making claims that it's uncomfortable. So we try to do it with everyone has to market in a certain way. And I just felt like in getting in the natural and organic side of this business, I wasn't aware how much, you know, thought leader proselytizing goes on out there. And sometimes it's to a dangerous level that makes me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Certain supplements do it, certain drinks, certain snacks. And so we had to try to follow the right line that I felt comfortable with. I want to sleep at night knowing that we're being honest with people. So we're going to make highly nutrient-dense snacks out of plant-based things like fruits and vegetables, try to process them in the most minimal way, but I'm not going to badmouth someone that might be frying something and eating meat or something like that. We're just here to like make people make small little changes in their life. And then they can buy a bag of kale chips once a month or a bag of beet chips. Over time, they're going to see this isn't goofy. It's not hippie food like was thought in the 60s. It's now mainstream. So that's the voice that we're coming out with.
It actually tastes good.
Yes.
All right. I'll close it out with this final question. What's the revenue right now, annual revenue at Rhythm Superfoods?
Yeah, so we're right in the $15 to $25 million range. I like to keep it somewhat esoteric. There's a lot of competitors out there. We'll probably have our biggest segment of growth. We're right now in the middle of 2017, and so the second half of this year and the first half of next year is all about utilizing this brand new plant that we just built, the added capacity. We're scaling up with a lot of growth over the next 12 months. So we're going to see a big growth curve over the next 12 months.
And you're available online on Amazon?
Yes, we are.
It is very expensive, though. Isn't it for an Amazon chip, or am I misreading the sizes of it? Rhythm?
Yeah. 2 ounces?
Let me take a look. Okay. So yeah, actually, I have to be honest, I don't know like what 2 ounces means. And that's one of my problems with shopping for food on Amazon. I can't tell, am I going to end up with a big bag or a small bag? So here, 2 ounce, right? 4 packs, 2 ounces each. I think, is that $23? Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's not a bad price with, you know, kind of the marketing and delivery costs that what it takes to do business with Amazon. So you're looking at, on average in retail stores, it's anywhere from $3.99 to $4.99 for a kale chip. Uh-huh. And to give a context to that, so it's like a little 2 ounce thing of kale, right? But it starts out with this big bunch of kale. Like if you were to buy a 14 ounce or 16 ounce bunch of fresh kale in a supermarket, that's what it starts out with. We take it, we take the stems off of it, gets triple wash cleaned. Then we mix it with a flavoring sauce that's made out of sesame seeds and sometimes cashews and seasonings to bring a
nacho
flavor to it.
Nacho is the one I'm looking at right now.
And then you throw it in a dehydrator, and what may have weighed previously over a pound evaporates out of the exhaust chamber of the dehydrator, and we lose about 90% of the weight when we dehydrate it. So that big salad of kale, and it's like you'd have trouble eating the entire bunch of kale yourself, dehydrates down into that 2 ounce 2 ounces of kale chip. So you've basically got what started as an unedible amount of fresh kale dehydrating down through evaporative loss of the moisture inside the kale to a little 2 ounce snack. So that's really where the expense is on dehydrated products. Like if you look at freeze dried fruits and stuff, you're getting little half ounces of strawberries for $3.99 because the strawberry was there and plump and heavy, and you know, you pay $4.99 for an entire pound of them, but you lose 95% of it in the dehydration process.
I see, and it looks like the Amazon Fresh version is always cheaper. So, and that's probably because of their shipping methods for that, where it's like their cars, or sometimes I even notice the post office cars come with their bags.
Yeah,
But look at these ingredients, by the way. As we're talking, I'm looking at the bags, I'm pricing it on different sites online. Here are the ingredients for the nacho version of the kale chips. Kale, sunflower seeds, tahini, which is just ground sesame seeds, onion, red bell pepper, apple cider, vinegar, cane sugar, carrot, sea salt, garlic, lemon juice, and chipotle powder. There's nothing here that I don't recognize. I don't know why I never thought to look before.
Wow. Yeah, and is that the nacho one? So there's not even cheese in it. So we're able to achieve this kind of nacho-y flavor without it putting any whey protein or whey or milk or cheese or something like that, cheese powder.
And only apparently one ingredient is non-organic. Anyway, congratulations on this business, Rhythm Superfoods, for anyone out there who wants to go check it out. Thank you so much for doing this interview. And I also want to thank my two sponsors. The company that will host your website, right, is called HostGator. Check them out at HostGator.com/Mixergy. And Final Call, if you want to come see me live, and we'll, you know, let's say grab a drink. We will grab a scotch, but we'll also hopefully go rock climbing and do other things. Come check me out at Fireside Conference. The URL is FiresideConf.com/Mixergy. Scott, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you all. Bye, everyone.